Hello, Little Saigon, Seattle, all you folks out there. It is November the 16th, just after 6 p.m. here in Seattle, Washington. And I am really lucky to have a friend of mine, a guest on the podcast this evening by the name of Josh in Alabama. And it's up to him how much of his personal biography he wants to talk about. But what I am going to say is we're going to sort of cover some eclectic topics tonight. One of the topics we may discuss is this question of whether or not it makes sense to commit yourself to something like art, for example, if your end is near. And another issue that might come up is this issue of, is the prison, and when I say prison, we all know what we're talking about. You know, you ever see that silly show, Orange is the New Black? Is the prison a good metaphor or a good basis or entry point for conversations involving existence? So anyways, I'm going to say, hey, Josh in Alabama, and why don't you tell people, you know, a little bit about yourself?
Hey, Dan, good evening. Or dobry vecher.
Dobry vecher.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a bit about myself. You know, I'm learning Russian, as you know, trying to. I have me a Russian textbook that I've been using, and also some things online. I also just got me a Russian-English New Testament, so I can start reading. Not really at a high reading level yet, but it's just something I had an interest in. Half serious interest and half kind of, you know, there's some funny Russian memes out there that I wanted to enjoy a bit more. So it's kind of a half serious, but half, you know, crazy fun sort of thing, the reason I'm learning Russian.
I think that's pretty cool. You know, it's good to practice the art of self-improvement. I must be blunt, as my listeners well know, in the last few months, I have not been practicing the art of self-improvement really much. And I am. I don't know. Can you still hear me okay there, Josh? Just double checking.
Yeah, I'm getting you pretty good now. We were having some audio issues there before.
I mean right now. Okay, cool. I just was double checking. Okay, so let me ask you, Josh, if it's okay. Is there a specific topic you would like to talk about at this point?
Well, let's see. You brought up the art at the end of the world thing and also the prison thing. You know, let's talk about the prison thing, because that's kind of the situation in which we find ourselves. And maybe from that, we could go from, okay, we find ourselves here in the prison. Now, you know, how should we approach things like art and love and, you know, things like that?
Sounds good.
So the idea of prison philosophy, either written in prison or about prison, you know, I'm kind of the mind that, you know, the only philosophy that really stands in the end, the only thing that, you know, that's going to hold up at the end of the day is a way of viewing things that will serve you in prison, be it, you know, literal prison behind bars like Boethius or the Apostle Paul, or, you know, just the prison of existence, like Arthur Schopenhauer talks about.
Interesting. What does Arthur Schopenhauer have to say about our existence and the prison?
Well, here's what Arthur Schopenhauer has to say about, you know, our existence. He says the best way to regard the world is as the penitentiary. And while we're here, you know, this is where we live out our sentence, and this is where we repent, so to speak, although he's not really speaking in specifically Christian terms, although he borrows some Christian terminology. You know, what are we doing here? You know, we're in the penitentiary repenting, and that's kind of what our existence is.
Can I pause you for a second, if that's okay?
Yeah.
Some of this feels like the crap, and I'm not saying Schopenhauer's crap, but some of this feels like the stuff that I was told when I was raised Catholic And some of this sounds like the stuff that a lot of medieval people were told over and over again, that life, you know, here on Earth is kind of a just a struggle and a preparation for the eternal life beyond. And even though that might be true, there was a lot of cruelty that was practiced because of that belief. Is that a fair statement?
That is definitely a fair statement.
I mean, once you contend that life itself is a kind of penitent act, then the question is, how long do you wear the hair shirt? Do you wear it until you die? And can I add something else here really quick as a thought provoker, maybe? Because you're getting into Russian culture. But I can tell you that it's weird. When Americans approach Russian culture, it's often difficult for them to say, how do I disconnect my American mind? Because a lot of Russian culture is alien to a lot of people. They don't quite connect the dots. And I don't think it's just about the Soviet period. In fact, I think that here's my opinion about the Great Terror and Stalin. You know, Solzhenitsyn once commented that at any point in time, neighbors could have defended neighbors against the secret police. But they didn't. And here's my idea I'm throwing at you, Josh. What if it has to do with this? What if the Russian people, culturally speaking, because of their culture and maybe even something else, what if they kind of have this belief that they deserve to be punished?
Well, it's one thing, you know, well, here's what I'd say. If you care at all about love or justice, you can't simply stand by and, you know, let other people suffer unjustly.
Yeah, but like I said, Schopenhauer contends, what you said is he contends that existence might be a kind of penitence. So doesn't that mean that if the secret police come to your neighbor's door, it is the righteous punishment of existence, and ergo, whether it's a secret police or a fire or being hit by a car or just the pain of existence, like having a loved one die, what if it was, you know, it's part of the penitence? I mean, I'm being kind of a jerk here on purpose, Josh, because I kind of think this is an interesting topic, but at the same time, I always worry, to what extent does this kind of philosophy justify, you know, saying, well, if life is a penitent act, then why don't we emphasize that? Why don't we emphasize the torture and the control?
You know, it may be your act of penitence or, you know, penance to suffer whatever befalls you in this life. That might be your lot. But to me, that doesn't mean, ergo, you should be the one to go out and cause excess suffering. That is evil, to go and cause, you know, there's the inherent suffering of existence, and then there's that which doesn't need to be.
So basically, we're all going to suffer some, and I agree with that. We're all going to suffer, but it's the additional suffering that it should be the focus of our attempt at remediation.
Yeah, I would say so.
Let me ask you another question here, Josh. Do you think there is any escape from the prison?
Escape in what sense? Temporally speaking? Spiritually speaking?
I would contend every sense, because we live in strange times. I mean, there are people who believe that the universe is a simulation. And it's not just people who went and saw the movie Matrix. There are professors at the University of Washington, I think it's at the UW, who believe they can prove that the universe is a simulation. Now, do I believe the universe is a simulation? No. But in a way, it kind of makes me think about this whole idea of how we grope. We grope and we grope and we crawl to find the corners of our prison cell. We do this as humans. We're not just humans, maybe life too. Life generally gropes to find the boundaries. What if prison is simply a more complicated metaphor for boundary conditions?
Boundary conditions. I like the way you put that.
I'm looking from your, you know, because the thing is, you're, so if the audience doesn't know this, Josh is, you know, like half my age. So he has a younger perspective. And I don't know and please do not be offended by this, because it'll sound a little condescending, but it's not the intent, Josh. I don't know if you completely understand to what extent your life is far less free than my life was when I was your age.
How could I understand?
Well, therein lies the problem, right? I mean, how do you bridge the gap? How do you communicate? Like, okay, I read Plato's Republic very long time ago when I was in college, you know, younger than you even. And Plato's Republic can be thought of in different terms. And for those of you in the audience who don't know about Plato's Republic, Plato was a Greek philosopher. He lived roughly in the fifth century BC, around about the time of, I think, just after the Peloponnesian War ended. And Plato uses Socrates, who was a real person, but Socrates didn't really write anything. Plato wrote down either things Socrates said, or he simply used Socrates as a voice piece. In either case, Plato was a Greek philosopher, and Plato's Republic is a very long dialogue. In fact, I would contend it's probably the longest dialogue, but I haven't read all of Plato's dialogues. But Plato's Republic is a very long dialogue, and I used to think to myself, well, Plato's Republic, it's a kind of architectural manual for a totalitarian society. But isn't that just another way of saying that it's an architectural manual for a prison?
Yeah. What is a totalitarian society if not a prison for your body, for your soul, or however it is you choose to regard our existence?
And here's the other thing, too. This metaphor of the prison, Josh, is a good metaphor, but it's weird. It's gotten me thinking about too many things at once. Josh, are you familiar with the Marxist concept of alienation?
Alienation?
Yeah.
Broadly, but explain. Explain what you mean.
I'll totally explain it. In fact, I will use an example that Karl Marx used. Karl Marx would say, Josh, imagine if you were a cobbler. Okay, you're a cobbler. You learned your trade of making shoes. You learned it from your father, who learned it from his grandfather. Maybe you joined a guild. But imagine you were a cobbler, a shoemaker, in the 16th century or the 17th century, just before the age of industrialization. You had a connection to your work, a deep connection, like a powerful connection. And in addition to Karl Marx, Heidegger also meditated on this idea of how connected you are to what you do. But Marx believed that the age of industrialization, amongst many things that it did, it alienated people from their work. Like, it used to be the cobbler made the shoes. Now the cobbler goes works in a factory, and he pulls a lever or pushes a button. And what Marx would say is that that action in the factory is not the same as the action of making the shoe by yourself, and also that there's something lost. That's basically Marxist alienation. And are you still there? Because, folks,
yeah,
you don't know.
Yeah,
I have to double
there.
Check the audio because we're doing Skype, and it's just one of those things. But does it make sense what I just said?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So here's the thing.
I'm broadly familiar with Marxism, although I'm not as in-depth familiar as you are. I know you did a lot of reading in that area back in the day.
Way, way, way back when I was about 20 years old, I went through a brief flirtation with a lot of fucking stupid Marxist thought. Now, I will forgive myself because I was 20, you know, and so that's it. You know, I could have been into punk rock. I wasn't. I should have done something else. Instead, I became really interested in Marxism. And, you know, it's pretty much a dead end. I mean, the deeper you go into Marxism, the worse it is. But here's the thing. Even though Marx identifies alienation, what he proposes as a solution, in my opinion, Josh, is the most alienated society you could possibly fucking imagine. A society that has so distanced itself from the tempo of life that people really, they don't even know what it means to be human. I mean, what does it mean to be? What does it really mean to dehumanize? Doesn't it mean to strip away all the features of what makes you human?
Yeah. So I guess the question is, what makes us human?
Well, I would contend, and this is just my personal belief, but other people agree similar things, that in addition to clean water and healthy, non-poisonous food and air that doesn't poison us, humans need liberty. We have to have it. I don't think it's an option. I don't even think it's special to us. Like, you know, if you look at other social creatures, I don't see them building prisons. Now, you could say, oh, I call bullshit, Dan. You need technology and science and all the human brains to have prisons. Although, boy, does that pose some interesting questions. But when you look at nature, do you see prisons, Josh?
No. The birds are flying. The mountain lions are not, well, you know, they're just out there doing what they want.
But
the animals aren't in prison.
Well, right. But I mean, in a way, it's like the difference between a march, a waltz, and disco dancing. When I look at crows, when I walk down the streets of Seattle and I see crows out, you know, hunting for their food and whatnot, I don't see them clashing with humans. I see them fitting into the dance. And that's what happens, in my view, when people want to understand the beauty of liberty and why it's preferable to living in a prison. It's because once you get into that dance, you realize, holy crap, humans can solve lots of problems without pointing guns at each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, do you know what I mean by fitting versus not fitting? Think about a prison. What is a prison? You try to force people into the same box, right? Everybody fits in the same fucking box. But does that even remotely match reality?
No. It's not. We weren't made to live like that. We weren't made to live in the box or behind bars.
Because you drew a distinction I thought was important, and it may have been in a previous conversation, but Josh, you drew this distinction between the suffering that Schopenhauer talks about, and other philosophers have discussed in the last couple hundred years, this suffering that is intrinsic to human life, maybe even intrinsic to consciousness. And then there's that additional suffering that is not necessary. And what my argument would be is life itself, per Schopenhauer, per common sense, life itself already has boundaries. We're already constrained. It's not like we need shackles. The universe itself provides us with all the potential boundaries and walls we could possibly want to break through as we grow older, as we mature, right? Why would we need to add more walls?
You don't need to add more walls.
You don't believe that, but there are a lot of people who do, Josh. A lot of people your age, a lot of kids your age are buying into Marxism because they think that a Marxist society will be a just society. And here's the funny thing about Plato's Republic. Plato's Republic starts with the question, in the conversation between Socrates and Thrasymachus, it starts with the question, does might make right? Okay? And that's not necessarily a great question, but it leads, you know, Socrates and his fellow travelers down a road. And again, I don't agree with where Plato ends up, but at least there is that, you know, tipping the hat, so to speak, to the basic question of what is it? And I don't know if I'm phrasing this right. What does it mean to be a good person, you know, in the world? What does it mean to live a good life? Is it a life where you seek out the prison, or is it a life where you try to escape from it?
You know, my conception of the good life is the life where you try to escape from the prison and not build prisons that, you know, okay, yeah, what the distinction, you know, between the inherent suffering of existence, you know, there's the prison in that sense. And then there's the excess suffering that we make ourselves, either inflict on ourselves or upon others. You know, we hurt ourselves and others in so many ways. That prison doesn't have to exist. But at the same time, I also don't know how to tell people, you know, we don't need those extra layers of prison. I just know that as I look at things and I see it, that's not the world I want. It's not beautiful to me.
Well, in Plato's Republic, Josh, it is kind of implied, as I recall, in the allegory of the cave, that the messenger of truth, the guy that escapes the cave and comes back and tries to tell the truth, is more or less attacked.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
And I don't know if that's simply the nature of the case. And here's the thing, too. Plato's sneaky, just like Marx. I think Marx is sneaky intellectually, so is Plato. Plato tries to frame things in terms of this is the way the universe works, okay? But I don't know that anywhere in Plato's Republic does he really make that sound of an argument that this is the nature of the universe. I mean, he does propose a model of the soul, and then he says, oh, if the soul has to be like this, then the government has to be like this. I mean, that's what leads to him thinking that there needs to be a special caste of people, that ultimately reason should rule in the soul, reason should rule justice and the spirited element, and that's the model for society. And now we just got to go find the special people to run things. I don't know. I don't know how you explain to people that they're trapped. And then you add into that the human ego. Like everybody,
you know,
wants.
And then you start to suggest that they're trapped and they don't like to hear that. Oh, you're wrong. How can you think such a horrible thing?
How can you say such horrible things, Dan? Yeah, exactly. Why are you so negative, Josh?
Yeah, what do you say to that?
I don't know. I mean, in my own failure as a human being, this is what I say. I say, do I currently have the money so that if I walked up to the Chevron gas station and needed to buy a six-pack of beer, I could do so? Truly, the way I respond to this irrationality is not in a healthy, happy way. I haven't given up on people. This is where I'm at. I think a lot of people are stuck in a kind of weird crazy right now. Not everyone, but a lot of people. And you could say, well, maybe you can push them out of their crazy. But what if they really need to process their crazy? I don't mean hurt people. I don't want people hurt. I don't want people going out and, like, you know, harming themselves or others because they feel crazy. But it might be okay to work through your crazy. You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
I mean, I got the question of all questions I ask myself every day, and it keeps me grounded as a Christian because it's constantly forcing me to question my faith. And that is, what if the human race, and not just the human race, but what if life itself is doomed? What if life was always engineered to try to break through boundaries, and in the process ends up destroying itself? I don't know. I really don't know. But I will say this, when I look at nature, I don't see much of the stupid crap we do to each other. I don't see a lot of prisons. I don't see a lot of marching. I don't see a lot of machine gun nests. I don't see a lot of, I mean, okay, I will say this, insect colonies, they kind of creep me out. I will be blunt, dude. Bees in the beehive, that does seem like a metaphor for communism. But I don't want to live like a bee or an ant. Do you?
Yeah, because we're not bees and ants. You know, maybe that suits them. Maybe, you know, their existence is different than ours, and that's entirely appropriate to, you know, their natural law, I guess you could say. But us, we're different. We don't have the same needs as the insects. We are not insects. We're people.
So getting back to this other question, you're in your situation, okay? You are in a situation, Josh, so am I. So are the people listening to our conversation. And let's say you're a passionate artist in a situation, I don't know, maybe you're in a prison, maybe you've got stage 4 cancer, Maybe you were just notified by the President of the United States that the world will end in 3 weeks. You are an artist, and you're writing poetry, but you know that the end is nigh. I know that my current response to that is really shitty. I just kind of just turn my back on my art to some extent. But what do you think about that question? Like, how do you respond to the prison or to your circumstance? How do you respond to the fact that there may be a boundary that either nature puts up or man puts up, and we're part of nature. How do you respond to that boundary that might not be penetrable, that you'll never break through?
So, like, okay, if you have, okay, the example you used, stage four cancer, you know, if you have stage four cancer, or if you know the world is somehow going to end in 3 weeks or, you know, 3 days, okay, you know that either the world or your world is going to end, you know, what's the point of art? What's the point of poetry? You know, why would you do that? Or would you do that? You know, me personally as an artist, I would say yes, simply because I have things in my soul that I want to externalize, and I'm not doing it for, you know, the world, for other people necessarily, or, you know, to be seen and recognized. I do my art, you know, for the other reason, because I can't help but do it. Ultimately, I think that's the best reason for art, you know, because all art is about the tension between love and death.
That's really beautiful. Like, the whole love-death thing. Well, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, but, you know, there may be good reasons not to. Okay, if you're some great poet, if you're Dante of the 21st century and the world's ending in 3 weeks and you're writing the 21st century inferno, what could we call it? We could call it Panopticon. You're 21st century Dante writing Panopticon, and you're going to finish, and you can do it in 3 weeks, but in 3 weeks the world is also going to end. Do you finish? Well, yeah, but, you know, might there be a reason not to finish? Yeah, perhaps. If there are people you need to spend time with, if there are people who need to know you love them, if there are people you need to forgive, in my mind, that takes priority over finishing the work of art, because art is really just in service of the greater thing, which is love.
Okay, so can I dig a little deeper on what you just said?
Sure.
Can you just basically said that in that situation, you should instead, for example, seek forgiveness and forgive. Is that a fair statement as one example?
Maybe. It may not be a choice. You might be able to finish the poem and, you know, love the people you need to love while you have time. Or maybe that is the way. Maybe, okay, if I finish the poem, then, okay, these people I know who are literary people can read it in the last 3 days they have left and marvel at the, you know, great work you did just before the end of the world. So you may not have to choose between finishing your art and loving the people around you. But if it was a choice, if it was, you know, if it came down to it, me, I think I would prioritize, you know, loving the people around me, if those were mutually exclusive, which maybe they're not.
I mean, I agree with you. The thing that I struggle with is, how do we justify it? Like, I agree with you. If I had a choice between finishing a poem or trying to seek forgiveness at the end of the world, I would do the seek forgiveness part, but then the question is why? I know why I think I know my reason why. What is your reason for wanting to choose the forgiveness route over the finishing the poem route? And let's pretend it's mutually exclusive. Let's get out of this, you can do both. That might be true, but let's pretend it's mutually exclusive. That things, because things are going to break down. If it was 3 weeks till the end of the world, it's not like it's going to be easy to get from A to B. So you're really going to have to be committed as a poet in the middle of nowhere or someplace safe, mm-hmm. or do this other stuff. But it's not like you have lots of extra time to do everything you want to do. What is your justification for choosing the forgiveness over the poetry?
justification for forgiving forgiveness over poetry.
These are choices.
Yeah,
these are choices. And we're having a conversation. This is technically the field of ethics, right? You know, it's not just enough to say you should do A, but you need to provide a basis for it. Like, what is your rationale for this?
Here's what I would say. You know, life, you know, love is the thing. Life is the thing. What is art but life in miniature? You know, if you can have the art, then great. But, you know, art is the thing that is in service of life. So, you know, life.
Well, okay. You said art is in service of life, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that true of every abstract fucking thing we create? Like, I don't care if it's language, poetry, machines, cities. All of these things should be in service of human life, correct?
Correct.
See, this is where it's kind of getting weird, because that whole conversation about alienation earlier, I wanted to see if we couldn't head in a certain direction, because one of my concerns in recent months has been the degree to which human beings are separate from the things they should not be separate from. And that includes love, oh, by the way, which is horrible, because if you look at the way we treat love now, love is so abstract. Love is so compartmentalized. There's sex, and there's love, and there's relationships, and there's marriage. And then there are the tools we use to find love or friendship. And these things are highly abstract. But it's not just that. It's the food. It's the way in which we exist. We are so separate from our connection with life. When you compare us to like a chimpanzee or a tiger, I wonder if that separation has kind of, and I don't know how to describe this, but has put us into a kind of addled mental state from a civilization perspective. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, like for example, I saw a woman with a, and folks, this could be a woman or a man. This isn't about women. But I saw a woman with her child in a stroller the other day. And she was staring at her phone as she was rolling the stroller down the street. She was in motion, folks. She wasn't stopped. She was looking at her phone, one hand, the other hand holding the stroller. And it occurred to me, one of these things is more important than the other. Which one is it?
You know, that baby is the most precious thing you have. You know, forget the phone. Hold on to your baby.
Yeah, but you see, you just answered the question as someone who... And again, I'm not claiming this is true about you, but the way you just answered the question leads me to believe that you are more connected to what is maybe foundational, right? You used the word life, and that's a good word. Life is kind of foundational. But the people I see, especially in big cities, they are so disconnected from life that even their baby isn't a baby. Their baby is a college fund. Their baby is going to be an honor grad. Their baby is going to go in the military. Their baby is going to be bisexual or trisexual. I mean, think about how fucked up it is. Imagine you're a parent and you have a 7-year-old kid. This is a real story, 7 or 8 or 9 years old, okay? And your kid goes down the wrong aisle at the mall and looks at the wrong kind of toys. So you as a parent, being all enlightened, decide, holy fuck, my little son Timmy is looking at the Barbie dolls, ergo, he must really be a woman. How disconnected from life must you be that you would ever go down that insane chain of reasoning? That's kind of my point here, dude. Like, that's disconnected. That's not...
That's hard for me to fathom, Dan.
But
I don't really know what to say about that.
It's a real thing.
I know it's a real thing.
Yeah, it's creepy.
I know it's real. I know it's out there. But, it just doesn't, it would never occur to me in 100 years to think like that.
But you would agree a lot of people these days, especially, and again, I'm not going to beat up on young people, but maybe it's because of the information you were given. A lot of folks these days, and it's not just young people, it's everybody. This is how they see the world, dude. They really have become secular. It's like when people say, is God dead? Well, I believe in God, so I know God is not dead. God cannot die. God is everlasting. That's what that means.
Mm-hmm.
But in the context of human society, in the context of how we relate with each other, I don't know if it's God is dead or Lucifer rules. I mean, it's hard for me to decide which is true that day. Some days I think God is dead in our society. It's simply the secular, atheistic, you know, dark pit of nothing, okay? And therefore, yeah, anything goes, blah, blah. And then some days I think, no, this looks like Lucifer, you know? I don't know. But here's the thing, though. In both cases, it's monstrous, okay? It's monstrous how we are objectifying ourselves and each other. And what's worse is people want more of it.
Yeah, I know. But again, you know, that's not the world I want. And, you know, I look at the things in horror, and honestly, I don't know what to do about it. I'll tell you what I do, Dan. You know, you have your Chevron six packs. I have my books, you know, old books by dead people to try and stay
that
out of the...
That doesn't make me feel better, Josh, though. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but...
Oh, no, it's not supposed to make
you feel... You're doing the right thing.
Better.
Josh, you are doing the right thing here, okay? You're describing this as a sin, but it's not. What I'm doing is wrong. What you're doing is right. You see what I'm getting at?
Well, I was going somewhere else with this, Dan. I wasn't, you know, saying anything about your drinking as such. I was just saying, you know, okay, you know, ways to deal with this. If you see, okay, this form of the prison that we're talking about, what I do, you know, I just try to stay out of the now as much as possible. You know, try and keep my mind in other, you know, other ages, other centuries, or even just other parts of the world. You know, it might be some weeks it might be Tolkien, some weeks it might be the Viking sagas, some months it might be the Italian Renaissance or, you know, Japanese folklore. Something I've been doing lately is listening to LibriVox and the stories, the legends of a Russian legend called Ilya Muromets, you know, a knight. And, you know, he was very weak and frail as a child until the age of 30 when some pilgrims came by his home and blessed him, and he was given, you know, supernatural strength. And, you know, he went forth and did great deeds. But all this stuff is, you know, it is outside the now. It's not the news. It's not the television. It's not the music you hear on the radio. I couldn't tell you about much of any of that, Dan, because I frankly try to avoid it. Not that I keep my head in the sand. I'm broadly aware of what's happening and, you know, some of the ugliness. But the thing I know to do right now is to, you know, simply protect myself by avoiding what I think I should probably be avoiding.
I gotta say, I think that is a wise, it is a wise position. I'm not saying it's the only position, given our circumstances.
No, it's not the only position. There are plenty of other ways you could perhaps deal with it. You know, instead of, you know, avoidance, maybe you could go head on and do combat with the evil. You know, maybe that'd be the way I go more eventually, but I need more time before I can get there.
I wonder sometimes, Josh, like, and this is a good subject because it is drifting inadvertently into one of my concerns or fears, but I wonder sometimes, if you were in hell, how would you know?
If you were in hell, how would you know?
Okay, I'm not going to say this. For the listening audience, I'm not claiming my life is hell. My life is fine. Compared to most of the people on planet Earth, I think I'm pretty fucking lucky. But I got to be honest with you, man. There were a few months last winter where I came really close to thinking, maybe this is hell. Okay, maybe my recurrent existence in this pathetic way that I exist is really my punishment. I know that sounds crazy. And also, it's kind of sociopathic in a way too, and narcissistic, because in the process of defining my hell, I've defined you out of existence, kind of, haven't I?
Maybe you could say that, though not necessarily. Explain a little more. I'm trying to understand.
If I was going to punish, you know, the thing about punishing people, and I think Dante came close to this, but I'm not really sure he totally figured it out. But the thing about punishment is that the key to punishment, and it's really this fucking simple, is it has to be about pain. Okay? There are people I have met in this life who have their wires crossed. So if you feed them pain, either existential pain, physical pain, any kind of pain, okay, maybe except for champagne. But the point is, if you give them pain, that gives them pleasure, okay? And it maybe even gives them existential pleasure. So if hell were a place where you as a being were physically and mentally tortured for all time, then for some people, I got to be honest with you, Josh, for some people, that might be heaven.
Huh. Some heaven.
Well, but here's the thing, though. Imagine you're God and you need a hell. And, you know, whether Lucifer realizes it or not, Lucifer works for God. But imagine if you need a hell. If I was creating a hell and I had one of these evil fucks, these sociopathic fucks who apparently enjoy both causing pain to others and their own pain, you know what my hell for that person would be? And I don't know if you're going to like it or not. You know what it would be? I'll tell you. It would be like waking up Sunday morning for eternity. Ted Bundy would have to wake up at 5 a.m. every Sunday morning with very little or vague notions of who he is, really, and go directly to church every fucking morning for eternity. I actually think that would be closer to being hell for Ted Bundy than having, you know, a chunk of hot metal shoved up his butt. The metal stuff's going to work. You see what I'm getting, though?
Yeah, I see where you're getting at.
And I don't want to misquote this. Have you ever heard of Master Eckhart?
Master Eckhart. I don't think I have.
I'm not super familiar with him. And if anything, given the kind of reading you're doing, I might recommend Master Eckhart because I'm not a super expert, but what I know of his work and his thoughts on human existence is the kind of stuff that I think would interest you. But I think Master Eckhart once said something to the effect that it's possible that hell is for education. And I'm paraphrasing. But it's possible hell exists as a way to teach us.
Master Eckhart, you said.
Yeah, and again, this is a really foggy...
Not Eckhart Tolle or
anyone? No.
A different Eckhart.
Very, very, very different. I don't even want to talk about Eckhart Tolle.
Okay.
I have not researched that guy. Here's my rule. Before we continue, Josh, and maybe you can add to this completely off-the-subject outburst, but here's my rule currently. If it's on YouTube and it's popular, in all likelihood, it's a lie. I know that's not a fair heuristic. I know it's not 100% true, but Josh, I got to be blunt. At this point, go ahead.
Oh, no, finish yours
first. No, that's basically it. If it's on YouTube, it's probably not true, or if it is, or it's just a sophisticated lie. The point is, it's about deception and control. If it's on YouTube, it's designed to manipulate you. Fair enough?
If it's on YouTube and it's popular, whether it's true or not, if it's good, there are probably better sources for what they're saying. And if it's not good, then it's not good.
You know what a curator is, right?
Yeah, a curator.
You know what? Well, that's what Google is right now. They are a curator of information. And they are telling us about the information they think is good and the stuff that's crap. They're boxing it up and they're putting it outside in the basement someplace or someplace else. I think that when I look at YouTube, I'm seeing something that's curated. So when I look at YouTube, I am seeing how Google wants me to think.
You know, I mostly use YouTube, you know, things like that, Google, YouTube type stuff for non-serious things. You know, if I just want to listen to some music, I can look it up. You know, that's one thing. Or if there happens to be a, you know, speaker or someone I like. Well, that's one thing. But the information they specifically curate and want to put in, you know, on the front page or the recommended or whatever. I'll generally just not pay attention.
Well, I went off on the segue because, you know, I will go to YouTube to listen to music, and there's like one or two podcasts I still listen to, mm-hmm. like maybe only one, and then it's music. But I feel like a lot of these quote-unquote gurus and teachers and internet philosophers that are currently very successful, and what's important, not being banned, a big part of curating is not destroying. To me, it means Google has a reason for them to be highlighted and popular. So if it's Eckhart Tolle or Jordan fucking Peterson, you name it, I don't care what the flavor of the fucking week is. There's a lot of these people on YouTube now that seem to be impervious to attack. And yet they often say things that are just as outlandish as the people being banned. So it leads me to believe that Google wants us to listen to certain people
and not others.
Yeah.
It certainly I don't think that way.
I mean, doesn't it seem
hard
like
to
that?
Say. Maybe. I don't know. It's hard to say. But yeah. You may very well be right.
So if you were in hell, how would you know?
If I was in hell, how would I know?
How would you know? What would be your philosophical process of figuring out that you have been condemned to an eternity of pain?
Perhaps to be in the presence of God and His love, and to not be able to receive it. Perhaps that would be hell.
I agree, but the thing is, though, aren't there people in this life who are so evil that they don't really give a shit about hearing God?
Oh, yeah.
So what would be their hell?
Hmm.
Or maybe what you're saying is your hell. See, this is where it gets tricky, Josh, because you just described the hell that is, I would say, not just a good description, but an apt description that gets closer to the truth. However, the fact that you could describe hell in those terms leads me to believe you're never going to go there, okay? The fact that you described hell in terms of hell is the absence of God's love, the impossibility of it. You can never have it. He is separate forever. The fact that you see God in those terms leads me to believe you'll never end up in that place. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, like, what would, like, hell for other people, what would that be for them? What would their hell be?
I can tell you what my hell is. I figured it out. In fact, I wrote a short story about this several years ago. I don't know if it's very good, but the hell for me is what I call the infinite gray nothing. Imagine if you took a snapshot of America today. Like you could literally take a snapshot of the entire quantum state, every particle, every molecule, every person, every building. And then you could simply slightly modify that, slightly adjust it forever. So it'll change a little, but the basic guts of it is this nasty, mediocre, slow motion train wreck of the human heart, the slow diminution of the human soul, the destruction of humanity by slices. Does that make sense? By slices, like little slices. And I don't want to get into the parable of the boiled frog, because that's really not what I'm talking about here, dude. I'm talking about the slow motion loss of existence. I will die in my hell, dude. I will die going through the same cycles of frustration that I've gone through until I die in my own private kind of hell. That this is, you know, the way I live in the city, the work I do, it is dehumanizing. And it's I don't know how else to phrase it, but it's toxifying. It infiltrates your heart, your soul. It leads you to believe that people are just like machines, and they're not. And that life is like machines, and it really isn't. That's my hell, dude. And I guess you could say, am I living my hell? Well, right now I'm not, Josh. at this moment talking to you, here is one possibility. I'm not in hell because I'm talking to you. Well, I know it sounds crazy. I'm not saying you're special, although I like you're cool, dude. But the fact that I'm talking to you and the fact that you're talking about God in the way you are might be possibly an indication that I'm not in hell. But if you want to know, if I had to live this existence and I couldn't talk to you or talk to some of the other people I know, and that's what I mean. Like last January, I was in a really, really bad place. And I think I was emailing you, but you're about the only person I was really talking to. And to me, it was like, yeah, I'm crazy. I'm angry. I'm old. I'm burnt out. I don't like my work. There is no work for me. Why don't I just simply just go off someplace and die? But at the same time, I don't want to die yet because there's still a couple things that make me happy. So that weird tension of knowing you want it to end, but you don't want it to end.
Yeah.
And being in a place that you can't think you can escape from. I mean, this is well-worn territory for existentialist authors. This is maybe the basis of, you know, No Exit or Waiting for Godot. I mean, ultimately, if you're stuck in a place you can't escape from and it's just a big, dark, nothing place from your perspective, isn't that fucking hell?
Certainly seem like it.
And here's another thing, too, Josh. What if, and again, I don't want to get too religious, but what if God, in his infinite wisdom, gave us little tastes of hell? Like, in our life, we do go through struggles and pain, and sometimes it can be so bad that people want to die. And what if that's also, I mean, maybe that's what some of these philosophers talk about, and I don't know if Meister Eckhart really is the best example of this, but maybe this is part of it. Maybe the reason why some philosophers think of suffering as education, okay, suffering as learning, is because maybe there's some truth to it. Like maybe God and maybe the universe, if you're not religious, needs us to suffer to learn. I don't know. Do you learn when you suffer?
Yes, no, not always. Sometimes I suffer and I just don't learn the lesson properly like I should. But, you know, when you suffer, that is an opportunity to learn.
I think so. Before we end our podcast, I'd like to talk about one final subject for a little bit. Is that okay?
Sure.
And it is related. There is a lot of animus, anger, really a lot of directed aggression towards people these days who are categorized as negative or pessimistic. You'll see commercials. Like I saw a commercial on YouTube the other day, and I've seen this commercial a few times. And I have to turn it off or skip it because it really depresses me because it makes me – I just don't want to go into it. It reminds me of when my sister Nancy was dying. But it basically was a commercial that said the following. People dying of cancer should only have positive people around them. Get rid of the negative people. And I will tell you something. If you've ever studied Scientology, that whole suppressive person, you should look up the definition of what a suppressive person is. A suppressive person is basically someone who maybe is a pessimist, maybe is negative. My question to you is A, why is there all this anger towards the pessimists and the negative people and the critics? And B, isn't it kind of unhealthy to have a society where everybody's happy all the time?
Well, I have nothing against people who are happy or generally positive, but to me, it's not whether you're positive or negative, quote unquote. In fact, I really tend not to think in these terms of positive and negative. It just doesn't really enter into my vocabulary. You know, what matters to me is, you know, do you love the people around you? You know, whether you express that love in a way that's, you know, happy or sad. Or, you know, otherwise, maybe you see the dark side of existence and, you know, and that's just your mode of seeing things and perceiving things. I don't think that makes you a bad person. And I don't think, you know, someone's bad for being that way. I don't know, you know, as for why all the animus toward negative people, quote unquote negative, again, I don't really think in these terms, but if I had to answer, well, I don't know. This might just be something for me to think about. But
I mean, I have my own beliefs on this, but I've expressed them so many times. I sound like a broken record. I have my own beliefs about it, but you're right. Maybe it is something to think about. Maybe it's something for me to think about a bit more too. I am who I am. If someone were to ask me, Dan, have you always had this dark view of things? Pretty much almost from the beginning. I gotta be blunt. In fact, it drove the nuns crazy. It drove the nuns crazy. I was basically not a joiner in a Catholic school, and I was basically a contrarian, and I was kind of a smartass. So you put all that together, it drove them crazy. But this is not new. I've always had a jaded view of things. It has gotten worse, I will tell you this. And I'll also add one other thing I spoke about the other day. It feels like the closer we get to whatever is going to happen, the worse the feeling gets. Like it goes in cycles, dude. Don't get me wrong. It's like waves. But the waves I kind of picked up back in 1975 were ripples, like pebble ripples, like little ripples that something ugly is someplace, but I don't know where it is, and I'm 5 years old, so who gives a fuck, right? Now it's like these don't feel like ripples. These feel like flashes of heat from a blast furnace. Now, does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I get what you're saying.
And so is that negativity or is that perception? Like, okay,
I would call it perception. I myself would. But maybe that's just because I tend to incline toward, you know, the darker things. One of the things I read by Tolkien, it's not The Hobbit or The Silmarillion or The Lord of the Rings. It's called The Children of Húrin. It's all about a melancholy hero named Túrin Túrinbar. And he was described as a melancholy person. You know, he was not, quote unquote, positive. He was not that type of hero. But where was I going with this? Yeah, I don't really recall.
It's okay.
I felt like I was going somewhere with that, but whatever.
Dude, it happens to me all the time. In fact, the fact that it happened to you and you're a young person makes me feel better. So it happens to all of us. It's a train of thought. Sometimes that train of thought goes off the rails, folks. We all know this. It happens. It just happens. I worry about this because the way I see the world alienates a lot of people from me. And I'm using this term in a slightly different way from alienation in the Marxist sense. It disconnects me from a lot of people because of the way I see the world. And also, I force myself to be disconnected because you know how you said we shouldn't add cruelty? Like, if we accept that life is kind of cruel,
yeah,
we should at least first do no harm, right? First avoid adding cruelty. Well, the problem is, if I'm right about what's about to happen, which is what I call vaguely the great discontinuity, then it's kind of cruel to go around to my family members, for example, and say, holy shit, you know, half the people you know will be dead in 10 years and blah, 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 and shit like that. That's kind of cruel. And it's one of the things I've noticed in recent years, like I need to not do that. And I don't. So, you know, I typically don't do that. I try to avoid it. But one of the ways I avoid it is by cutting myself off physically from people. Like sometimes I have to be alone for a month or two. In the last decade, last 10 years, I have to be alone for a month or two sometimes because I just cannot handle, and I don't even know how to describe this, but call it the emotional energy of a crowd of people who are slowly going crazy. I can't deal with it, you know? I'm sorry if that sounds horrible, but there are times when I say I just can't. And here's the other thing, too, before I pass it over to you, Josh. And are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Think about this in terms of seeing in the dark, okay? Nobody would ever say, well, nobody should see in the dark because darkness is terrible. That's stupid. We want people to be able to see in the dark, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
Well, isn't this kind of the same?
Some kind of torch.
Yeah, or maybe it's what's part of who they are, but the point is, the darkness is still a real thing, even if you have a torch. There are still shadows.
Yes.
In fact, yeah, with a torch, maybe it's even worse.
You know, you only have some... You can see just a little bit in front of you, but you have the black nothingness much, much further all the rest of the way.
Right, and you could argue that even with a torch, the restrictions of human existence are never more clear than at night. The restrictions, the boundaries, the fact that we're not God. I'm not God. You're not God. We're not superhuman. We are both mortal. We could both die one day. In fact, we will both die one day. This will happen. It's inevitable, you know? So here's the thing. If being dark is part of existence, too, in terms of person's spirit or personality or whatever, could it be useful if only because these are people who might be able to show us our way in the dark because they were there for a while? I don't know. I truly don't know. I want to understand the purpose of people like me because it isn't to add cruelty. I'm not going to do that. So what is my purpose? Is it just to simply observe something I know is going to happen? And please, I don't want to get into the Cassandra thing because that is depressing. I got to tell you, Josh, the Cassandra mythology depresses the fuck out of me.
What's that, the Cassandra?
Cassandra is doomed to know the future, but no one believes her.
Is that Greek?
Yeah, it's Greek, and it's horrible because essentially you know what's going to happen. It's 100% certain, and no one will ever listen to you. And I'm not saying I'm 100% certain, dude. I hope people don't get the wrong fucking idea. I'm just a burned-out middle-aged computer programmer who probably is drinking too much right now. But that particular mythology of someone trying to tell the truth about what's going on and being destroyed, or in this case, being ignored, which in some ways is bad. In fact, maybe ignoring someone is a kind of destruction. But the point is, what is the message? What is the message of the allegory of the cave? What is the message of Cassandra? What is the message of our whole adult life? People come along, they try to tell the truth, and they're destroyed. They're isolated. They're alienated. They're told to go away. I mean, I don't know, Josh. And it's not just about the future. It's about the present, too. I can tell you with certainty that there is no moral argument I can think of that justifies aborting a baby once it is born. I can't think of one right now. I really can't. Can you?
No.
But that's a thing now. That's a thing that is becoming legitimate in the sense of the law, and in the sense of the Latin origin of what legitimate means in terms of the leges, in terms of the fucking law. That is becoming fucking legitimate in the United States of America to conceive, to debate, to have a conversation, and to actually kill a baby once it's born. How do you tell people that's wrong, and what happens when they just ignore you? How do you explain it to them?
I wish I knew what to tell you, Dan. I don't know how to tell people that the things are wrong. I just have an overriding sense that it is wrong, and an overriding sense of sadness.
So maybe it is this, maybe this is the truth of things. Maybe, and I'm not going to call this hell. And maybe condition is the wrong word, but maybe the condition of human existence for some people, not all people, but for some people, is to actually observe people making mistakes that you know they could avoid and that they simply will never avoid.
Hmm. That's horrible.
Can I ask you a question? Do you like camping? You like to go camping ever?
Oh, yeah. I like the outdoors.
What does the concept of leave no trace mean to you?
Concept of leave no trace?
Leave
when you
no
go
trace.
Out in the woods, you know, don't litter, for one thing. You know, respect the environment where you're in. And so when other people come to use the campground, it'll be just as good for them as it was when you were there. Maybe even a bit better.
Right. So why is it when we get home, and I'm not saying you, dude, I'm talking about generally, why is it when humans get home from camping, they forget those ideas? Because I can tell you, a city, historically, it's not brand new, and I've said this before, a city, historically, like stacking humans, you know, like stacking Bengal tigers, a city, historically, is like a dagger stuck into nature with the hilt sticking out. It always has been. Cities are insults upon nature. There's never been, in the history of civilization, a city that did not do damage to its immediate environment, okay? So why is it, as human beings, we can follow the leave no trace philosophy and completely forget about it when it comes to our daily existence?
Again, that might be something for me to think about. I don't have anything really to say off the top of my head.
Well, I bring it up because this whole conversation, we were thinking in terms of the prison, right? And that's important. I love the metaphor of the prison. In fact, I could see us, and I hope we get to do this more in the future, I could see us returning to that metaphor, the prison. But then you have to ask yourself, not just the question, am I a prisoner? But there's a deeper question. Do I not have responsibilities as a prisoner? Is there not a part of this that is my fault? You know, the power of these people, the power of the jailer, the power of the system, the power of the mechanisms of control, a lot of this is simply our own work, our own effort. We're in the forge daily, creating chains we put on ourselves. I don't know. It's something to think about. Anyways, Josh, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
For this Saturday, and it's almost... holy crap, it's just after 7 p.m. here in beautiful Seattle, Washington, maybe beautiful to some people. I don't know. But yeah, it's just after 7, and we have been talking about a lot of different stuff for the last hour. Josh, I want to thank you for joining me. And
thank you for having me on, Dan.
Oh, yeah. Before we go, is there anything else you want to say?
Sure. Learn to love, learn to suffer. That's what makes sense to me in the days ahead.
I like that. I like it. Learn to love, learn to suffer. It's hard, though, because some people would say if you learn to suffer, you're learning to accept it. But as you and I both agree, there's different kinds of suffering. That's why why this is hard, because if you say learn to suffer, based upon the context of nature, I get it. And then it's like, learn to suffer. Then I'm thinking of Torquemada and the Inquisition and the fucking Catholics and putting people on racks and you know, barbecuing them. I say, as we both agree, that's suffering that's completely unnecessary. So I don't want to learn to do that. I don't want to learn to make it happen. That is learning the world. If we forgot about how to torture people, Josh, if that was knowledge we lost, and again, I'm a supporter of free speech and knowledge, but if literally I had to pick one body of knowledge to erase from humanity and I had no choice but to pick one, I think I would pick the science of torturing.
That'd be a good one to eliminate.
Anywho, for this Saturday night, thank you, Josh, and for all you folks out there, have a great evening.